this was not the case at all. It was a simple business partnership. Tesla celebrated the new connection by giving a large party at the Waldorf Astoria. He had discussed with Oscar the details of the menu and participated in tasting the various sauces. Impeccably dressed, he reserved one of the smaller banquet halls, requesting his guests to arrive at 7:30 sharp. White was probably there, along with the Johnsons, Hobson, and perhaps Miss Merrington, or Vivekananda acolytes Miss Thursby or Miss Farmer, or Anne Morgan. As legend tells it, when it came time for dinner to be served, the maitre d' was forced to call Tesla aside to inform him that he owed the hotel back bills totaling more than $900. He was under orders. Dinner could not be served unless the matter was straightened out first. With an ace up his sleeve, Tesla nonchalantly welcomed his guests and then eased out to see the manager. Mr. Bolt was cordial but insistent, so Tesla made a call and put him on the phone with Morgan. Flustered, Bolt was nevertheless able to hold his ground. A check was sent immediately, and the inventor was saved from embarrassment. Soon after, Tesla met with real estate mogul Charles R. Flint, who arranged a meeting with James Warden, director of the North Shore Industrial Company. Warden, who was in control of an 1,800-acre potato farm on Long Island Sound in Suffolk County, provided Tesla with 200 acres adjacent to what is today called Route 25A. The inventor was also given the option to purchase the remaining parcel. Perhaps to sweeten the deal, or in lieu of certain other arrangements, the site was named Wardenclyffe after the owner, and a post office under that appellation was established on April the 2nd. 5 years later, in 1906, the name was officially changed to the village of Shoreham. Electrical World, an engineer, reported, "The company is offering its stock for sale at $100 per share, expecting to pay 15% dividends. The Wardenclyffe Building Company shall have the first right and privilege to do all building and make all constructional improvements, and shall have the first right of purchase of any additional land offered by it for sale." Warden, who was interviewed for the article, predicted that large profits will be realized in the future. Describing Tesla as the foremost electrician of the age, whose achievements in electrical science eclipse in practical importance all other discoveries of the century, Warden noted that the inventor has just closed a contract to expend a very large sum of money in constructing electrical laboratories and the main station for his wireless telegraphy system of communication with Europe and Australasia. This development will require a large number of houses for the accommodation of the several hundreds of people whom Mr. Tesla will employ. Tesla's ultimate plan was to construct a world telegraphy center, with a laboratory, wireless transmitter, and production facilities for manufacturing his oscillators and vacuum tubes. He had negotiated with Morgan the first step, that is, to build the laboratory and a simple tower for reporting yacht races, signaling ocean steamers, and sending Morse-coded messages to England. Simultaneously, he discussed with McKim, Mead, and White the construction of an entire metropolis, a model city, using the 1,800 acres available, with homes, stores, and buildings to house upwards of 2,500 workers. Wardenclyffe will be the largest operation of its kind in the world, Tesla told the local newspapers. The laboratory will draw men from the highest scientific circles, and their presence will benefit all of Long Island. With a staff of 75 draftsmen, the eminent architectural firm of McKim, Mead, and White is well suited to the task, Tesla concluded. They billed him for $1,168 for blueprints. White, it appeared, was placed in a precarious position. Morgan still had reservations about his connection with the flamboyant engineer. In his capacity as interior decorator, White in February had located a statue in London which he knew the financier was interested in. "My dear Commodore," the engaging redhead wrote, "it is really like parting with a piece of my heart to give it up. Thus, I would honestly rather present it to you than sell it, as my only desire is to please you." But Morgan insisted on compensating him for the statue, paying White double the normal commission, in order to show that he too felt their affiliation transcended business. April the 26th, 1901. Dear Nicola, I send you with this a new revised plan for your powerhouse, also a very close estimate which we have made ourselves in this office. The work could be done for about $14,000. I am very sure for a building of this size that it would be impossible to get these figures down lower. Affectionately, Stanford White. Bids were taken from Sturgis and Hill, and also Mertz and Company, two contractors White often worked with. In May, blueprints for the laboratory were sent over to Tesla for his approval. In June, a contract with Sturgis and Hill was finalized, and in July, the land was cleared and a road was put in. White recommended one of his associates, W.D. Crow, as architect in charge. Crow would also do the actual construction of the tower. The sun was out bright one morning in the early spring as the inventor strutted down Peacock Alley and up Fifth Avenue towards 42nd Street and Grand Central Station, to transfer to Pennsylvania Station and take an early train to Wardenclyffe. Golden shafts of light billowed through the upper windows of the cathedral-like edifice as Tesla crossed the mighty corridor and stepped aboard the luxury car. Ordering a pot of coffee, he began to peruse his mail. The train rattled out of the city, past Manhasset, Oyster Bay, where Vice President Roosevelt lived, St. James, near Smithtown, where White had his family estate, Port Jefferson, and finally to Wardenclyffe. With stops at the various towns, the trip took about an hour and a half, the Connecticut shoreline sometimes visible across the sound. It was when he reached page 280 of the Electrical Review that his jaw dropped and his cup of coffee spilled all over the prim white tablecloth. Syntonic Wireless Telegraphy. Guglielmo Marconi. A large amount of inaccurate and misleading information is being published, even in the scientific press, on telegraphy through space. I shall endeavor to correct some of these misstatements. It is my intention to describe fully the efforts I have made in order to tune or syntonize the wireless system efforts, which, I am glad to say, have been crowned with complete success. I first constructed an arrangement which consists of a Leyden jar or condenser circuit in which included the primary of what may be called a Tesla coil, and a secondary which is connected to the earth or aerial conductor. The idea of using a Tesla coil to produce oscillations is not new. It was tried by the post office, i.e. with Preece, when experimenting with my system in 1898, and also suggested in a patent specification by Dr. Lodge, dated May 10, 1897, number 11, and by Professor Brown in 1899. Tesla described to Morgan in a letter written 3 years later how this information affected him. When I discovered, rather accidentally, that others who openly cast ridicule on what I had undertaken and discredited my apparatus were secretly employing it, evidently bent on the same task, I found myself confronted with wholly unforeseen conditions. Your, Morgan's, participation called for a careful revision of my plans. I could not develop the business slowly in grocery shop fashion. I could not report yacht races or signal incoming steamers. There was no money in this. This was no business for a man of your position and importance. Perhaps you have never fully appreciated the sense of this obligation. This passage displays misunderstanding by Tesla of Morgan's personality. Unlike the inventor, whose ideas existed in abstract and futuristic forms, the pragmatic financier's mind was on the present. Morgan loved sailing and yacht races and would resent another suggesting what a man in his position should or should not do. Tesla reveals in this letter that he had to change his plans due to the advantage shrewd competitors had, e.g., due to Marconi's pirating and connections with Pupin, Edison, European investors, and sovereign rulers. He thereupon decided to abandon the agreed-upon scheme of building a modest-sized transmitter and replaced it with the idea of constructing a skyscraping tower 600 feet high, designs for which he scratched out on his fancy Waldorf Astoria stationery. Ironically, for the oft-times altruistic Tesla, it was his greed, vanity, and megalomania which drove him into the new venture. To have his ideas stolen from him was abhorrent. In his autobiography, Tesla would later refer to Marconi, although not by name, as a parasite and microbe of a nasty disease. It was at this moment that the inventor decided to scrap the trivial idea of sending mere Morse codes across the Atlantic. He would inaugurate a world communications enterprise to pulverize the vermin as a pachyderm would crush a toad. Having reached the pinnacle of the ruling class, Tesla's self-image swelled with the occasion, for he had conceived a telecommunications enterprise more efficient than the combined forces of today's radio, television, wire service, lighting, telephone, and power systems. His ultimate plan even included the production of rain in the deserts, the lighting of skies above shipping lanes, the wireless production of energy for automobiles and airships, a universal timekeeping apparatus, and a mechanism for achieving interplanetary communication. Having attained cosmic consciousness, he offered this creation to the king of the financial world, and the king had accepted. To the inventor, it was simply a detail that this vision was not in agreement with the specifics of the contract, or that Tesla never really told Morgan his greater scheme. This work, like White's statue, transcended the traditional rules of business. Panic on Wall Street. It was just 60 days since Tesla had signed his contract with Morgan, 30 days after Morgan sailed for Europe. Yet already, Tesla had irreversibly changed his plans. Since he had been a gambler and pool player in his salad days, and was now living among the most audacious of high rollers at the Waldorf, these old tendencies resurfaced now that he had hooked the biggest fish on Wall Street. He had calculated the odds based on certain assumptions about the stability of the economy and the quickness of his access to Morgan's $150,000, and he proceeded boldly with the completion of the masterwork. How could the inventor know that on May the 10th the stock market would crash and that the main culprit in the catastrophe would be his backer, J. Pierpont Morgan? The collapse of the stock market occurred because of a bitter rivalry that existed between Morgan and Ned Harriman. Morgan, who was in charge of the Northern Pacific Railroad, having tossed Henry Villard out a decade earlier, had bought control of an enormous line called the Chicago-Burlington. This concern stretched its tracks from Atlantic ports to Chicago and down the Mississippi all the way to New Orleans. Harriman, who controlled the Union Pacific, or southern route to the west, wanted access to the Burlington as well, and he tried to negotiate with Morgan for a seat on the board of directors. Unfortunately, due to bitter disagreements stemming from an old railroad deal in which the crafty Harriman had outwitted the Commodore, Morgan came to detest the man. Therefore, he would not share the Burlington and became irrational whenever Harriman's name was mentioned. Thus, while Morgan enjoyed his art purchases in England and his mistress in France, Harriman, with the help of his broker, Jacob Schiff, clandestinely began purchasing Morgan's Northern Pacific. Instead of trying to outbid Morgan for the Burlington, Harriman boldly bought Morgan's own holding company out from underneath him. To accomplish this coup, it would take the adventuresome Harriman close to $100 million, which he raised by selling enormous blocks of Union Pacific bonds, and Harriman actually successfully carried out the operation. By the first week in May, Harriman owned more than 50% of Morgan's precious company, which had been affectionately called the Nipper. When Morgan received the fateful telegram from his underlings while in France, he tossed his paramour off his lap and wired back the order to buy Northern Pacific back at any price, for Harriman did not yet own a majority of the voting common shares. On May the 9th, the stock rocketed from $150 to $1,000 per share. A panic ensued as people who bought in on the Nipper were unable to obtain possession of their shares, as neither Morgan nor Harriman would release any. Most of the other stocks dropped when investors sold in order to cover their losses. The end product was the tumbling of the market and the creation of extreme economic and political times, and also monetary chaos. Stanford White was one of many who lost heavily in the market. For Tesla, costs increased dramatically, and credit was nearly impossible to obtain. The front page of the New York Times reported the calamity. "The greatest general panic that Wall Street has ever known came upon the stock market yesterday, with the result that before it was checked, many fortunes had been swept away." Even Morgan's precious U.S. steel dropped from its current price of 46 to a low of $8 a share. Numerous investors were financially ruined, and some purportedly committed suicide. One rumor concerning this famous event was that Morgan won back the company because Harriman's broker, Jacob Schiff, was in the synagogue on the fateful Saturday when Morgan began buying more shares of Northern Pacific. Schiff, however, never intended to wrest the company from Morgan. His goal was simply to obtain a large enough percentage of the company to force Morgan to give Harriman a piece of the Chicago Burlington. Harriman, in his frenzy, wanted to change their plan so as to gain control over all three railroads, but Schiff overruled him. Thus, the skyrocketing of the stock and ensuing crash of the market were based solely on Morgan's buy orders. The economic upheaval created heavy financial burdens on Tesla. However, he would not completely realize the increasing financial difficulties immediately, for the effects on construction costs, wages, and incidentals would ripple throughout the summer and fall. Before Pierpont's departure for England in April, he had assured Tesla that now he had no doubts about the inventor's abilities, and even if by some fluke of misfortune Morgan should not supply the additional funds, Tesla still had his own money and the personality to attract additional investors. At 45 years of age, wealthy, established as a leader of his field, however controversial, and rubbing elbows with the creme de la creme, the tall inventor was well equipped for the task he foresaw. 31. Clash of the Titans, 1901.
Make a Tesla or buy a Tesla coil. I made one. Find it. Get books on wireless telegraphy.
From the private notebook of Thomas Edison. Throughout the late spring and summer, Tesla commuted regularly to Wardenclyffe, often with a servant of Serbian extraction and a box lunch from the Waldorf Astoria. At night, he returned to the city where he could stop in at the Players Club, attend a concert, or dine at Delmonico's or Sherry's. In June, having to forego yet another Johnson blowout, he apologized to Robert and Owen for being unable to meet the lady who inspired the celebrated author of The Arrows of the Almighty. White was on his yearly fishing vacation in Canada, so Tesla was on his own for the month. Some of the time was spent scouting out possible apartments to rent in Shoreham, and George Schiff also had to look for a place. In July, the architect returned, and talks resumed concerning the construction of the tower. Having recently joined the Automobile Club of America, which had its headquarters in Locust Valley, and counted Vice President Teddy Roosevelt among its members, White would motor out from the city to the club, or to St. James in his new steam-powered locomobile, which required a driver, or on his own, in a fashionable electric two-seater runabout. With his estate just a few miles from Shoreham, the avid motorist could drive out past the endless flats of potato fields along the same road that also led to the site of Wardenclyffe to oversee the work and perhaps take the inventor for a spin. The architect's son recalled, "I remember Tesla well, as he often came down to stay with us on Long Island. He used to wander around at night in the garden in the moonlight. And when my mother asked him why he wasn't asleep, he replied, 'I never sleep.' I also remember going to his laboratory in the city as a boy and watching him put several million volts through his body, lighting up two Crookes tubes which he held in his hand." White made Tesla realize that a 600-foot-high transmitter, roughly two-thirds the height of the Eiffel Tower, was simply out of the question. So Tesla dabbled with harmonic ratios of one-half and one-quarter that size. With prices so unstable, it would be difficult to calculate the new costs. The Johnsons were as excited as Tesla about the purchase of Wardenclyffe. By July, with the land cleared, it became an opportune moment to visit the site, just a few miles from a lovely beach on the Sound at Wading River, and also not far from Southampton on the Atlantic side. A weekend was set aside to coax Tesla into spending some time swimming. It was a delightful moment, a time to enjoy the salt water and picnic grounds and pose for whimsical photographs of their heads placed in the notches of standard billboard pictures of bodies in striped bathing suits or gaily adorned sitting in the seats of an imitation automobile. In August, with the frame up on the lab and plans for the facing underway, Tesla once again refused a respite in Maine with the Johnsons, writing a teasing letter that, as a member of the 400, he could not meet with people whose fathers had been fruit peddlers and grocers. Perhaps Catherine's father had been such. With the tower now planned as a much larger venture, and Morgan delaying payment of promised funds, Tesla pondered a way not only to obtain owed funds, but also to get Morgan to increase his investment. The monarch with the bulbous snout returned from Europe on the 4th of July. Leaving the ocean liner from the stern in order to avoid the throng of reporters, Morgan ignored his home and moved to the Corsair, his 300-foot-long yacht, living there for the month and staying in Bar Harbor, Maine, through part of August. The art connoisseur was pleased with his recent acquisition of paintings, gemstones, and rare manuscripts. He did not shorten his yearly European excursion on account of a Wall Street crisis. But he was irritable, irrationally perturbed with Harriman, and fearful that the press and public might threaten his empire, if not his life. Morgan was an opinionated man, fair-minded much of the time, but dangerously stubborn at other times. Having detested Harriman for outwitting him not once but twice, he must have been furious when the world viewed him as the villain who had destabilized the economy because of a personal vendetta. A turbulent labor strike by the steelworkers added to his unhappiness and the uncertainty of the times. Headlines such as the following caused him to seek armed protection. The rich denounced by socialist labor. Thousands at Cooper Union cheer wordy assaults on capital. J.P. Morgan accused of trying to trustify the earth. This is the century, said Chairman Lucien Sagnol, in which there is going to be social revolution. Whoop went the audience, waving hats and yelling madly for a minute or so. Charles Knoll followed and said he favored the adoption of such resolutions as would chill and make to shiver the spinal column of the capitalists. To end the Northern Pacific fiasco, Morgan and Harriman allowed investors to settle their accounts at $150 a share. The public was not supposed to notice that this price would yield hefty profits to the giants who had purchased their stock for one-third less than that price only days earlier. Instead, they were perceived as noble in their attempts to restore order and sanity to the economy. At first, the government wanted Morgan to return stocks to the original investors at original prices. In response, Morgan was quoted as saying that it would be quite a feat to unscramble the eggs and return them to their original hens. When accused of avoiding his responsibility to society, Morgan responded in anger, "I owe the public nothing." For this remark, Morgan would be interrogated by the governmental investigative committees until his dying days, but he weathered the storm easily. Before Morgan left for Maine, he met with the inventor. In a new satchel purchased for the occasion, Tesla brought his latest patent applications, drawings of the half-completed laboratory, and schematics for the tower. The secretary at 23 Wall Street ushered him in. "Mr. Morgan, you have raised great waves in the industrial world, and some have struck my little boat. Prices have gone up in consequence, twice, perhaps three times higher than they were, and then there were expensive delays, mostly as a result of activities you excited." "We've all suffered, Mr. Tesla," Morgan said, already perturbed and testy because of the more important imbroglios he was enmeshed in. Tesla pushed on, informing Morgan that he had decided to design a larger tower than agreed upon because of Marconi's piracy. Morgan looked on, at first in detached amazement, as Tesla continued, "Suppose a plant is constructed capable of sending signals within a given radius, and consider an extension to twice the distance. The area being then four times as large, the returns will become more valuable. Approximately computed, the average price will be tripled. This means that a plant with a radius activity twice as large will earn 12 times as much, but it will cost twice as much. The greater the distance, the greater the gain, until when the plant can transmit signals to the uttermost confines of the earth, its earning power becomes, so to speak, unlimited. The way to go, Mr. Morgan, is to construct such a plant. It will give the greatest force to my patents and ensure a monopoly, and offers possibilities for business on a large, dignified scale, commensurate with your position in life and mine as a pioneer in this art, who has originated all essential principles."
"Let me understand you, Mr. Tesla. You have not exploited the lighting enterprise?"
Not yet, sir."
"You have not constructed a transmitting tower, but you have just about completed the construction of a laboratory?"
"Yes."
"You have purchased, is this 200 acres, with an option on 1,600 more, and you have run out of funds?"
Only temporarily, sir. Once you supply the balance...
And if I relinquish these funds, will that be enough for the creation of your model city?
No, as I explained, if we double the size of the tower, I will earn 12 times as much.
Is that it?
Precisely.
Get out, Mr. Tesla.
But, sir...
Raising his voice to a dull roar, Morgan reiterated his command. Quietly, Tesla packed his satchel and slipped away. The inventor was in shock. One can only imagine which favored swear words Morgan, known on Wall Street for his gruffness and blunt expletives, unfurled upon the prima donna who had pranced into his office with his fantastic scheme and high and mighty demands. Tesla required a few days to regain his composure. Morgan still legitimately owed him a significant amount of funds. The banker was upset, with the problems, with the Northern Pacific, and with the ensuing denigration by the press. It will pass, Tesla reasoned. The best thing to do would be to re-establish credibility. He forwarded Morgan his most recent patent assignments and then backed off. The following week, White telephoned to suggest that they go with a rough stone facing on the laboratory instead of brick, and the inventor agreed. "Please make sure they also put in a fireproof roof," Tesla told his architect.
"Let's not rush the tower," White cautioned. "I'm still calculating figures for you."
As White was courting during these very weeks on a daily basis Evelyn Nesbit and also helping Tesla recalibrate the construction of the complex, it is possible that the tight-lipped inventor became privy to the architect's intimate liaison.
In a financial predicament, Tesla reported to White that he had visited the American bridge people to ascertain whether they will be able to construct the cupola of my tower without much delay. "As this item will consume the longest time, it is necessary to take all the preliminary steps so that the work may be begun just as soon as you have passed upon the plans. I believe that the American Bridge Company is the best concern to deal with in this matter," Tesla continued, "but I beg you not to pay any attention to my suggestion if you think otherwise. The Bethlehem Steel Company will furnish the sheets, but I cannot give the order until we have agreed upon all details."
"You must enjoy parting with your money if you are negotiating with American Bridge," White responded. "I implore you to let me handle the contracts. I should have the figures in a few weeks, but I can tell you right now, a 300-foot tower is out of the question, so we do not know what size the cupola will be. You must also consider the extra cost for designing the tower so that each individual strut can be replaced, if need be, without toppling the entire edifice."
"Please understand, Stanford, I went to the American Bridge Company simply because of my anxiety to have the work pushed through as fast as practicable. I'm only too glad to follow your advice and beg you to consider yourself absolutely free in your choice and arrangements regarding this work."
On Friday, September the 6th, 1901, President William McKinley journeyed to Buffalo to attend an exposition and see firsthand the remarkable project instituted at Niagara. Dwarfed by the colossal Tesla turbines, the president wove his way back to the train station, shaking hands with many of the onlookers. While waiting on the platform, a crazed anarchist lurched forward and fired at point-blank range. As McKinley struggled throughout the week at the edge of death, Tesla decided to write to the president's old-time friend Morgan, sending the appeal on the inventor's favorite day, Friday the 13th, the day the president died.
"McKinley's passing," Morgan cried, "is the saddest news I have ever heard."
Beginning the letter with, "I respectfully apologize for disturbing you at a time when your mind must be filled with thoughts of a more serious nature than usual," the inventor imprudently reiterated his recent proposal, suggesting that if Morgan doubled his investment, Tesla would be able to send messages across the Pacific as well as the Atlantic, or better yet, if Morgan tripled the amount, the wizard could send messages to any point on the globe, no matter what the distance. On the same day, he also wrote to White, who had finally given him precise figures on his proposed monster-sized tower.
"My dear Stanford, I have not been half as dumbfounded by the news of the shooting of the president as I have by the estimates submitted to you, which, together with your kind letter of yesterday, I received last night. One thing is clear. We cannot build that tower as outlined. I cannot tell you how sorry I am for my calculations.